Now wind east at 13. No rain near us on the radar. 46 degrees Racine, 47 Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and it's always a pleasure to welcome into our studios Dr. Art Seer Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, and a published columnist whose work appears in newspapers and journals across the country and indeed around the world as well. And we are always happy to have him once a month to offer his thoughtful analysis of various current events and issues. Professor Seer, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. You're always so gracious. Please keep going if you want to.
Well, I'm going to mention something which you learned in unpleasant fashion this morning, which is namely the main parking lot here in front of the Inspire Center is completely closed to the public because of some kind of truck training program. So you found yourself sprinting to the studio from distant parking. So for anybody who needs to come to the Inspire Center today or the administration building, you're going to find a complicated parking situation. Should probably allot a little extra time. So anyway, sorry about that start to the morning for you, but we're glad you managed to get here nevertheless on time and ready to go.
Oh, yeah. That's good exercise, Greg.
There you go.
I love to get some exercise in the morning.
There you go. Well, you're welcome then. At any rate.
Thank you so much.
Yes, right. So we have lots to talk about, and I think one of the things that we want to spend a little bit of time on is the situation right now between the United States and China, and in what is being described in some quarters as the beginning of a trade war of sorts. And I think you want to be sure to set the current situation in kind of proper context in a couple of different ways. First of all, maybe you could say a word about what kind of concerns have brought us to this place? In other words, what kinds of concerns on the side of the Americans, and with President Trump, of course, in particular, has prompted this recent action involving tariffs on imports from China? What has gone on before this that has led to this action and, of course, China's retaliation?
I've read in serious publications that President Trump has a very strong and strongly felt personal sentiment in favor of protectionism, and that's something to be kept in mind. I believe the fact that a lot of Americans, interestingly enough, especially in the Democratic Party, more than the Republican Party. The Republican Party, not just elected representatives, much less so, though that may be changing with the electorate. There's been steadily growing sentiment in favor of protectionism. Also, I also think there's some structural factors at play. The Chinese have been so aggressive in securing intellectual property for their own purposes, licensed and legally protected products as well, products of all kinds, not just software, is something that they're most anxious to have. And they've been quite ruthless as well as aggressive in securing this from foreign investors. If we can get them to be more flexible and more fair and live up to the global rules, which are now the standard of behavior, huge positive change since World War II. I think that's all to the good. It's also important to mention that the global economy is so vast. This is not 1929 and the 1930s all over again by any means, and I don't think it will be. The global economy is so vast, and global investment, not just straightforward exporting and importing of finished products, has become so interconnected and complicated. It's interesting that this has not had a big impact yet in terms of inflation, and I don't think it will.
So in other words, this same action, let's say 30 years ago or 40 years ago, would likely have been much more dramatically felt than it is right now.
Yeah, I mean, very well put. Especially by the president's strongest supporters. This is not just my bias. This is reflection of hard data in terms of who voted for the president and who supports him. Working people, relatively lower income people, spend a much larger percentage of their income on consumer durables and other consumer products that are really essential, refrigerators, car components, other kinds of mechanical instruments, T-shirts, clothing of all kinds, running shoes. And so the price that's being paid will be relatively high for the president's strongest supporters. I myself don't think that has any bearing on whether or not his strong base will continue to support him. I believe people who are committed to him will vote for him no matter what.
No matter what the pain might be of the price tags. But
There is pain, why is the fault of the Chinese, the Europeans, these other foreigners?
Right. But I think something else you're saying, too, is that because our global trade network is so vast and also so interconnected, even what you were talking about just now, a spike in certain prices, that to some extent that will be mitigated by just what a vast trade network we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a very good, clear description. We also have full employment, again, in striking contrast to earlier periods, especially the terrible times of the 1930s. And as long as you've got some cash coming in, other problems are manageable as long as you stay in focus, whether you're a large corporation or an individual citizen and worker.
Can you be more specific for a moment about the transgressions of the Chinese, at least from our point of view, and what you were kind of laying out in terms of the way in which they are really not behaving in a manner that most would say is appropriate for a major player on the kind of world stage today? What are some specific ways in which they have engaged in what you would probably characterize as unsavory and unfair practices? How has that played out?
I'm not an expert on trade and commerce and investment with China. I'm not an expert on China. So please keep that in mind. But outright theft, especially of entertainment material, music, video, old-time DVD, Also, if not the theft, the strong use of pressure to secure very complex and sophisticated computer and telecommunication software from companies that are dealing with them. Equally important is they're extremely heavy-handed, speaking of information of all kinds and data of all kinds. They're increasingly heavy-handed in imposing censorship on their own proprietary internet and search engine. Good luck with that over the long term. It's not going to work. But the fact that various companies, including Google and Apple, I'm sorry to say, currently, that used to resist this kind of pressure have knuckled under, I think makes it all the more important to pay attention to their transgressions. I have very strong feelings about this, and it's not a point of view that's easily placed on our political spectrum, but it's something that deserves more attention at a time when corporate interests, business and commerce, and demonization of other countries in broad terms is so popular in this country. We really need to focus on specifically what they're doing.
Right, absolutely. So it doesn't fall into the trap of just being kind of generally suspicious of anybody who's not from here.
Yeah, that's right. And censorship, from time to time, the president does mention this, but only in passing. Their emphasis and brutal imposition of censorship, I think, is particularly important. On the plus side, on the sunshine side, the fact that so many foreigners of all kinds, including our good students and faculty, but especially young people, are traveling to China, studying in China, doing business in China. One of their avocations, I know directly from my own advisees who've been over there, is getting around the Great Firewall. And you're not going to arrest, especially with the strong memories of Tiananmen Square in 1989, you're not going to arrest, you're not going to be brutal to particularly young people at a time of global media, whatever your national censorship.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I'm glad it is.
Right.
But it goes beyond specific products and specific telecom companies.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned, I think, I don't think I read this, I think I heard this in your real interesting conversation with Mitch Tyke on WUWM. You said something to the effect that China is indeed an economic powerhouse, but that a lot of what they produce is actually, I think you put it, not from necessarily indigenous Chinese companies or 100% Chinese companies, that there is so much foreign investment in China and that many of the companies there and factories there also actually have a very strong foreign investment component to them. And that is also a detail in this that we tend to miss, and that's probably important in terms of what it says about China and its economic strength, that it's not kind of the insulated, distant power that it once was. It's tied up in all the rest of us, whether it wants to be or not.
Yeah, General Motors, Ford Motor Company, Sara Lee Corporation, Quaker Oats, you can go on and on and on. The multinationals that are really making money, they're not state enterprises of China. There are a couple of firms, literally a few firms, that are doing very, very well with great state support. But the state industries involved in cement, steel, basic industrial commodity production, they're not doing that well at all. So the income is accruing to stockholders. And one of my favorite examples, as I struggled to learn about this, a large percentage of, I mentioned Apple, a large percentage of their iPhones are assembled in China. The components are put together. A great opportunity for intellectual theft and also pressuring the corporation for trade secrets. They're exported. A huge amount of value can be loaded on one large 747 or C-130, the successor to the 747s, whatever they are, and shipped directly to the U.S. That counts as a big plus for China's trade balance. But in fact, the value, the programming, the design of the components, the real value is added in elsewhere, notably especially the U.S. and to a degree Taiwan, which is a tremendous global high-tech center today. and stockholders, who can include people in China, but also others, mostly others around the world. They're getting value. So old-fashioned import and export figures increasingly are unrealistic. Mm. I'm not saying the trade deficit that we have is unimportant, but it's not that consequential. It's a relic from the New Deal when the Roosevelt administration was struggling to try to understand trade, but also trying to come up with figures that would help show the people that we're doing our job, a political or violent revolution, which was a possibility. But please stay away from that option.
Hmm. So the simple numbers, the blunt numbers,
yeah,
are a simplistic picture. And we have it's helpful for us to go kind of beneath the surface numbers to understand the real situation in terms of our trade balance or imbalance.
You also bring up historical context, which I take as a compliment, and in any case, it's important. One thing I emphasize to students in class and outside of class and others is China is the latest demon. Keep in mind, starting in the 70s through the 80s and into the 90s, Japan was the great threat, and using questionable and even illegal practices and shameless, blatant protectionism of all kinds, which was true, to gain advantage, they were going to be taking over shortly. Since students are so audio, and of course, we haven't talked that way for years for good reasons. Since our students are so audiovisual, and it's a good way to learn things, especially for an older person. I show video in class, but I get even by showing older films, older video, including the 1960 first of four Kennedy-Nixon debates, which is a fascinating exercise for me, as well as getting their opinions on the subject. The focus from JFK was the threat of the Soviet Union, and they're about to pass us. We're behind in the arms race, which was quite false. But they're ahead in education, scientists, engineers. They were first into space. 30 years from now, I don't want them to be so far ahead of us that we're at serious risk or we faded, which is rather quaint today. But that's what serious and informed people believed then, as well as Americans generally.
Wow.
And the Soviet Union, of course, is gone, as we don't need to remind our listeners.
Right. A last question about this. I wonder if you could explain, at least in a real basic way, kind of the mechanics of when tariffs are imposed. I mean, like the United States has imposed tariffs on a long list of goods from China, and of course they've done that in return to us. Typically, how are those tariffs, in a sense, sort of implemented? I mean, at what level or at what point does kind of the money change hands? I mean, is it as these goods reach our shores, or is it even before that that, in a sense, those tariffs have to be paid?
I'm also not an expert on the details of importing and exporting. There are a lot of people who make a good living who are brokers who literally do this. I don't believe it's an exchange so much of cash nowadays.
Right, right.
Young man, as it is ledger entries. Yeah, the president has considerable executive authority and within limits can raise tariff barriers, as the president has done. But if you do that very much or make a big change, you run into World Trade Organization rules that countries generally have accepted. And then the other country, the target of your tariff, will complain to the World Trade Organization. And China and a number of other countries have done that. China's problem is they've got various violations of their own, and it's also being administratively decided and litigated. It's enormously complicated. Not only brokers, but attorneys especially and other specialists make money off of this. Mm. The president can do certain things, but we do have laws in this country that restrict him, and we also have now a firm network of international rules. That's the clearest that I can explain a subject that's very complicated.
Right.
Now, the president has talked about, it's fair to say bragged about, the fact that we can really shut out Mexican goods if we want and Canadian goods if we want. I think it was about time that NAFTA be updated. In that sense, as with China, there are some good things coming out of this stirring of the pot. But NAFTA is a treaty. We'll see if the administration can get a new treaty through Congress. Mm. But NAFTA isn't a result of the kind of executive agreements the President Trump and President Obama favored overdoing the hard work of getting laws passed. NAFTA is a law that came into effect in 1994, and we have to stick by those rules, and we have, whatever the president might say or do publicly.
Right, right.
It shows the value of laws and treaties and actually doing the work of getting these things through Congress.
Yeah, not easy at all.
Bill Clinton, in fairness to him, was remarkably effective at that.
And he had to reach across the aisle. I mean, it was Democrats and Republicans that saw that to final fruition.
Yeah, he was a brilliant deal maker and really enjoyed it, and I believe one of the most intelligent presidents we've had since World War II in office. No, you're quite right. NAFTA, which I believe President Clinton wanted to get through the House as well as the Senate, even though he was not required to go to the lower house, both of them passed, and he had a larger proportion of Republican votes than Democratic votes, since in the 90s protectionism was already becoming a very powerful current in the Democratic Party. Lyndon Johnson likewise had an enormously successful record with Congress for a while in special circumstances, and the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965, he got those through with a larger proportion of Republican than Democratic votes. Johnson, of course, was a Democrat. In that era, the powerful Democratic base was in the South, and it's understandable he would need Republican support. But Republican Everett Dirksen of Illinois, right across the border, basically conservative, was crucial in that realm, civil rights, as in arms control and other areas, of working with Democratic presidents, Kennedy and Johnson.
Mm. And amazing to think back to a time when that kind of thing was possible. It sure seems in the realm of fantasy nowadays.
Well, I think politicians of that era seem not only more colorful, more corrupt, to be sure. It's fair to say that was very much characteristic of Johnson and others. Behavior that wouldn't be tolerated and is illegal today. You had more freedom. But also, if you wanted to survive in politics, you couldn't just be an ideological drumbeater and have a safe safe electorate that will keep returning you in these ideological times. You had to make deals. Otherwise, a very mature electorate, in my view, why is this guy still there?
Hmm. At any rate, speaking of political survival, you do believe that that at least the vast majority of President Trump's most loyal base are not going to desert him over any pain that they might feel from what he has done with China, including farmers, who, of course, form a really significant part of his base and are feeling probably some of the most direct hurt from this. But you are sensing that they're not going anywhere. I mean, they are not likely to leave the president over this.
I believe they could. I think farmers are a special case. Farmers are only 1 to 2%, believe it or not, of the American population today. They're not a large share of the electorate, which is why they're not referred to much, except in the news concerning not so much elections as the tremendous dislocations of these protectionist moves that we've been making. And the Chinese, as well as the Europeans, they're in retaliation targeting specific sectors, so not only farmers, but specific crops in states that went for Trump are being targeted. The whiskey business, important in Kentucky and Tennessee. The Chinese are focusing in on specific brands in terms of their so we're dealing with some very tough and very able opponents. But to get back to your question on the farmers, no, I think farmers historically have voted Democratic as well as Republican. In rural states, they punch above their weight. They have an impact beyond their very, very tiny percentage, but it is a small percentage. It's also worth mentioning that Harry Truman, in 48, a big factor in his stunning, unexpected re-election election victory after he'd succeeded to the White House, and everybody thought he was going to lose, and polls showed he was going to lose, farmers were drawn to Truman for all kinds of reasons.
Interesting.
It is interesting. But there's rural populism, and they're not automatically Republicans. That's the way we often tend to see farmers. But that's not true.
Right.
They're very savvy, very smart business people, men and women who know how to hedge with computers, who know how to trade in a sophisticated way in the commodities markets.
And what do you mean by the term hedge? Can you explain what that means? I don't know that term.
hedging, that is spreading the risk of where your money is located by buying futures contracts.
And farmers are good at that.
Of necessity, yeah. A farmer not only has a phenomenal a farmer who succeeds and makes money, not only has a phenomenal array of mechanized implements, some workmen and women, and works very, very hard, but also inside the house you will see a computer and sophisticated software for trading in the global financial markets. Commodities, including pork bellies, hog futures, corn, wheat, traditional agricultural commodities since the 1970s have gone from a rather small market to a gigantic global market. So agricultural products merge with all kinds of other commodities, including money, since Nixon ended fixed exchange rates in 1971.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating.
I've known a lot of farmers, and I know at least a little bit about farming, but that's one aspect of what they have to do nowadays that I know nothing about. So
I'm here to help you, Greg.
I appreciate that.
And you certainly helped me.
For those of you just joining us, our guest today on The Morning Show is Dr. Art Sear Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. This is his monthly visit to the program, and I'm glad we could attack this issue of the U.S. and China as thoroughly as we did. Let's move on to a few other things that are important for us to talk about.
Excuse me, one other point on hedging.
Yeah.
Because it's not an area where I have any particular skill or expertise, but it's a way of locking in a price. There is a range of prices, and you can lock in a price for delivering your product to the marketplace or less often receiving a product in advance. So whatever the unpredictable agricultural market does, you have, when your crop is finished and you take it to market, you can lock in that price, which is why the commodities markets were developed in the 1700s and then became substantial in the 1800s, based in Chicago. I worked in Chicago for 2 decades, and of necessity, I had to learn about the nature of the marketplace because corporate memberships and programming was extremely important for our work at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations.
Right.
So fascinating environment, fascinating world.
So when you're talking about pork bellies, you know what you're talking about then.
Well, it's a good example.
Yeah.
Because of the imagery.
Right. All right, on to other things. Let's talk about the two summits that have occurred within the last month, one between President Donald Trump and South Korean President Moon Jae-in, and another summit a few days later between Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Two obviously very different summits kind of playing out in a sense for different reasons. Tell us about these two summits and their relative significance.
There's been a trend over the last 2 decades, but especially in the current administration, to sort of ignore South Korea, an extremely important and pivotal ally. You were nice enough to mention one of my books and the Korean flag, Republic of Korea, South Korea, as well as the British flag, the Union Jack. And much more prominent, I emphasize the American flag. All three are on the cover of a book that compares our foreign policy in Europe and Asia. They really are, to my mind, a pivotal ally. If we're going to make progress of a durable sort on the Korean Peninsula, it's really important for South Korea to play a crucial role. The progress, very limited and fitful, that we have made in dealing with the bizarre regime in the North has been mostly a function of the six power talks, which are now on hiatus, but have included the two Koreas, Russia, Japan, China, and the United States, and that kind of multilateral diplomacy, which is tough, undramatic, takes time, and relies crucially on our very fine diplomatic corps. That's how you make progress. But South Korea is a dramatic, dramatic contrast with North Korea. And the more they succeed politically as well as economically, the more likely it is that some accommodation will be reached with the North. And Moon is very good at this. He, beyond the headlines, in great contrast with our current president especially, he's been working diligently with some success to open lines of communication and cooperation with North Korea.
I did not know until I read your column about President Moon Jae-in's father. Tell our listeners about where his father came from, a little bit about his story, because I think you believe this is a really important element in who the current president is and how he sees the world.
Well, he has a kind of mixed background. He was a humanitarian lawyer, very courageously during the brutal dictatorship of Park Chung-hee. He also was a serving military officer in Korean Special Forces and saw combat on the DMZ. He reflects, I believe, very much, especially given the importance of family in Korea today as well as yesterday, the very important personal legacy of his father.
Hmm. And do I remember correctly that his father is actually a North Korean refugee?
I think that's right, yeah.
I read that, and that was striking to me.
Like a lot of families, they're very much divided by the DMZ.
Right.
And one area, again, things blow hot and cold, blazing or freezing with the Pyongyang regime, but exchange of families is extremely important. Unlike Vietnam, especially, unlike Germany, you have a history of unity in Korea that was really, really important until 1945. And then the Korean War, of course, confirmed that division.
Mm. And many, many families feel that same split. So in a sense, it isn't maybe as remarkable as it might seem that the president of South Korea has a father originally from North Korea. That's a story played out time and time again.
Well, you're very, very shrewd to see that. I hadn't really thought. I'll think about that more. It's very, very important. Until the 60s, believe it or not, North Korea, which is now plagued with famine and one of the few, thank God, remaining terrible, criminal, brutal dictatorships in the world. Whatever you might see in the headlines or hear on nonstop talk TV and radio, democracy is slowly but surely spreading. And I'll be glad to spend more than an hour talking about that, not today. But North Korea into the 60s was more prosperous than South Korea. They've got a lot of minerals. The Soviets, and they're very closely tied to Russia and the predecessor Soviet Union, more than China. The Soviets poured huge amounts of money and expertise into building up North Korea as a showcase. The transformation of both countries since the 60s is really quite profound. And you make a very good point. I hadn't thought about that, but the kind of impact on families, it's got to be some kind of a riptide that's gone back and forth.
Yeah.
Because believe it or not, the North was better off until fairly recently.
In your column about the Putin-Kim Jong-un summit, you made mention kind of in talking about how the economic situation in North Korea, as far as we can tell, continues to deteriorate seriously. And one of the things you kind of mentioned in as you talked about that was a significant public event for Kim Jong-un at which he wore just a normal suit in terms of his normal, more customary uniform of his party or whatever. And I thought that was interesting. What would the significance of something like that have been within the context of what you were talking about?
Well, as you pointed out, he always wears a uniform in big public events. As good communists, the North Korean party regularly has party congresses, and I think it was in 2016.
I think that's right.
He appeared in an expensive business suit and talked not about the class struggle and the imperialists and blah, 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 the usual monotonous rhetoric, but he talked rather specifically about the need for economic reform and economic change.
Mm.
And he specifically criticized the military. He survives because the military is committed to the survival of the regime. In an almost religious sense. He talked about corruption in the military, and he's fired and, we believe, executed some officers, including some who were quite close to the top. So that indicates a lot of turmoil beneath the surface, which I believe is one reason we have this erratic back and forth. It may well be that no one person is, in contrast to his father and especially his grandfather, no one person is in charge. But he talked about the need for change. So even this sheltered guy and the elite are getting the message that we've got to try to open things up. And they desperately try to have trade shows. They do all kinds of sometimes strange things to try to encourage investment. But it shows just how isolated and desperate they are. Hmm. For a while, not for a while now, but I was for a time getting emails from the news service in North Korea saying they would like to recruit interns. Your students will find a very rewarding and happy educational environment in the people's.
Wow.
So I deleted them.
I was going to say.
Didn't open any attachments.
Okay.
God knows where they came from, Greg.
So, wow.
Yeah.
And and your blood kind of runs cold at the thought of sending off poor unsuspecting Carthage students off to North Korea.
Yeah, well, let me hasten to add, there is certainly no...
no plans to do
internships
that.
Is a high priority of President Swallow, and we have our new Aspire Center. And all kidding aside, the fact that students work internationally more and more all the time, one thing we're doing at our Clausen Center is doing our best to promote these kinds of opportunities.
Right.
But North Korea ain't on the list, parents.
Right. Yeah, let's leave it that way. Yes, fascinating. Let's talk about a happier place.
Thank you.
Although it's not an entirely happy place, but certainly in many respects a positive story, namely Indonesia. One of your more recent columns talked about recent dramatic elections there and the fact that even though Indonesia has been racked by several really serious terrorist attacks, that nevertheless there is a very positive story to be told there, and that Indonesia is a country with which the United States should probably be dealing more and more. Explain.
We are commercially.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're a major oil producer. They are, I believe, the largest majority Muslim population in the world. It's an enormous country, physically, in terms of population. They've had an alternation in party, perhaps something that will happen in Chicago eventually, but they've had an alternation in party for the first time in history. So all kinds of things have been opened up. There's a major scandal currently, including allegations of misuse of very large sums of money in various parts of the financial system, including their sovereign wealth investment fund. There have been some interesting news stories, which are worth following, about allegations that the Obama presidential campaign in 2012 received tremendous aid from this unsavory source. We'll see if the media decides to pursue that collectively or not.
Interesting.
Let me stress, it's just allegations. But there'll be lots of interesting news like this. And they have had an alternation in party. Just a tremendous success story. They have had terrorist attacks, as you mentioned. But fortunately, only a few, thank God. Only one in a tourist resort killed a lot of people. Australians were targeted. Not just Westerners, but their close allies of the hated United States, as our listeners, I hope, know. Starting in World War II, including in Vietnam, the Australians are extremely important to this country and aren't mentioned enough. But the result of these terrorist attacks is Indonesia, the public has turned totally hostile to terrorism.
And I think the point you're making about the elections and the two parties is the fact that when you have a country that toggles between two different political parties, that actually, I should think, is sort of a sign of health.
Well, of course, that's what I've been trying to say.
It's the way it's supposed to work. And so that alternation between parties in leadership is a sign of a healthy economy democracy that is functioning it should.
Well, both, yes. Transparency and the rule of law are essential to both over the long term. And thank you for making the point clearly. Obviously, I was rambling on, but that's what I was trying to say, Greg. Thank you very much.
No problem. So let's talk about one of the more vexing issues right now for the United States, which is namely immigration. And you have written recently about how in the past, it's not the too distant past, although in some ways it feels like the very distant past, but in another time, it was possible to do the hard work of crafting meaningful immigration legislation. And you cited some examples of Democrats and Republicans working together quite effectively, actually, in terms of trying to carve something out. And obviously, we are still in a place where that needs to be done or those efforts need to be furthered, but it's a little hard to imagine that happening in our current polarized environment.
Well, the last big effective immigration reform goes back to Lyndon Johnson again in 1965. The U.S. dramatically reversed course, which we tend to do historically regarding immigration, going back to the origins of the of our great republic. Very restrictive, very racist immigration legislation became law in 1924. At a time when the Ku Klux Klan was extremely prominent and powerful in this country, and we were feeling pretty disillusioned after World War I. The vast majority of Americans opposed involvement in that war afterwards, until Pearl Harbor. The 1924 Act, which was hurtful in all kinds of ways, quite fortunately from my point of view, was overturned in 1965, and we've been pretty open since then. We also have a very large population of undocumented immigrants as well as legal, those who have legal credentials and entry. The Senate in 2009, I believe, passed major reform legislation. It was very much the initiative of the senators, but President Obama, quite rightly, in my opinion, began to emphasize publicly the importance of this. It was the byproduct of a lot of hard work by the Gang of Eight, so-called a bipartisan group, John McCain, who was quite prominent, a Republican from Arizona, also Marco Rubio, a very conservative Republican from Florida, who was trying to get presidential traction at the time, Charles Schumer from New York, now the Democratic leader. They got through the Senate a very, very sensible, very intelligent bill. It died in the Republican House. But one point I make in the article is that now the Democrats have the House, so it would be a good time to bring this kind of thing up again, and a good way of, again, from my point of view, calling the president's bluff. I believe he's been purely political in exploiting immigration, and this would be a good way for the Congress to develop some worthwhile self-respect. McCain and Ted Kennedy, again, a Republican and a Democrat. Kennedy was an extremely hardworking legislator and remarkably influential during his extraordinary tenure in the Senate, in great contrast to both his brothers, who served for short periods of time. And that history in detail, if you're really interested, is worth looking at.
Interesting.
It is interesting. And I think my own sense is things are moving such that whoever's elected in 2020, the numbers are so large, the controversy and dislocation is so great that there'll be some serious law passed. It's overdue.
Right. One would hope. Of course, another issue that seems to be making its way to the forefront at the moment is that of abortion, with the passage of a dramatic law in Alabama that really runs contrary to Roe versus Wade and seems designed actually to, in a sense, force a legal confrontation all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court over Roe versus Wade. What can you tell us kind of about this issue, how it has played out in this country, and are you surprised to see this emerging as such an important issue at this moment?
No, it's been a very high priority for activists who are strongly opposed to abortion generally. It's an issue that's much discussed from one point of view on public radio, and there's no shortage of information on the subject. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, is very conservative, has gone on the record, but also someone who's been interested in developing consensus, is saying Roe versus Wade is the law of the land, and we'll see what happens. The earlier discussion we were having bears on this. In 1968, Hubert Humphrey got the Democratic nomination, even though he entered no primaries. Meanwhile, Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy were carrying out a political death struggle, an intensely hate-filled campaign in the primaries, and they both won some. After that, and given the chaos and violence of that year, there was a movement very successfully to make primaries much more important. And now they are. They're dominant. The old-fashioned, more private political deal-making that was also important has faded.
In smoke-filled rooms.
Yeah. Keep in mind, Humphrey always ran ahead of Kennedy, and especially McCarthy, in terms of popularity with Democratic voters and likelihood of beating Nixon or Rockefeller, the two contenders at that time for the Republican nomination. That's clear. That's undeniable evidence. But to get to the point, relatively few people vote in primaries in this country, ironically, given the purpose of opening things up to the people. So those who have very strong views on abortion rights, or very strong views on the sanctity of life, or very strong views on race relations, or very strong views on crime, or very strong views on gay rights, or very strong views on defense, they vote in relatively large proportions. And that is a major reason why the issue of abortion, which is an important moral issue, but by definition extraordinarily emotional, has come to the forefront.
It will be very interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And it's the kind of subject that should be addressed in law, not the Supreme Court making law, but over the last half century, the political role and effect of the court has become much more pronounced. And so, social issues, as opposed to other issues, issues of personal choice and lifestyle have become much more important.
Right. And, of course, another issue wrapped up in this that probably also is not talked about enough is the fact that some people are pinning this issue of abortion on another issue, namely that of state rights, states' rights, that states should have the right to determine for their own citizens how they are going to handle an issue like abortion and, of course, other issues as well.
Well, states do have rights.
Well, some.
Huh?
They have some rights.
Yeah, well, yeah. We have a federal system, and states do have rights. That's nothing new. That's been a basic fact of our system from the beginning.
Right. But, I mean, some people are hoping that states will be given the right to determine, for instance, something like this, that the citizens of this state will operate under this abortion law and
yeah,
another state
exactly.
will operate under another. And that is not the situation at the moment.
But those who are really pressing for making abortion illegal aren't really interested in states' rights. They're interested in passing legislation that will be tested immediately and get to the Supreme Court.
Right.
The the far-right activists in Alabama, from my point of view, who are pressing, I mean, they're clear about that. We want this to go to the Supreme Court.
They want it for everybody. But they're pinning it on this long-time issue within the United States of federal rights versus states' rights and so on. It's just, it's an interesting tactic is all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting tactic, Greg.
Right. Well, that leaves us no time to talk about Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor, so we'll have to talk about him some other time.
The new member of the royal family.
Absolutely. And of course, there's a whole lot in the world for us to talk about.
Well, a whole lot of Carthage College, too. This is finals, and we have commencement this weekend.
We
absolutely
do.
Time of completion and renewal.
Absolutely. So, to everybody for whom this is an exciting, busy time, we wish them well. And Professor Artsir, it's a busy time for you as well. I appreciate you taking the time to be part of the morning show as you do each and every month, and we look forward, I hope, to seeing you in June. Thank you for today's program very, very much.
Thank you, Greg. We do have refreshments available at our Clausen Center for World Business on the second floor for students, faculty, and staff, not just in the registrar's office, who are feeling the stress of these times.
Very good. Thank you again for being part of the morning show today. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we talk about the Gateway Promise, which is a very intriguing program that operates under the auspices of the Gateway Foundation. It, in effect, provides to certain qualified students what amounts to a tuition-free education here at Gateway. We'll be talking with Jennifer Charpentier, who is from the Gateway Foundation, with two counselors, and also with a young woman who has been a fortunate and deserving recipient of funds from the Gateway Promise program. And so that will be our topic for tomorrow's morning show. The morning show is archived on our website, wgtd.org. And we remind you that it's also available now as a podcast via Spotify, Google Podcasts.